people in the Keys are still cleaning up, but when will they be able to accept tourists? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, it's been almost a month since Irma smashed through parts of the Keys Islands, leaving many homeless, and hopes of recovery is still months away. But tourism's so important to the economy there. When can tourists realistically start making their way back? Also on today's program, State Senator-elect Annette Tadeo will join us to talk about her surprising win in District 40. And Jim Morin will talk about his long and illustrious career as a political cartoonist for the Miami Herald. All of that is coming up on today's program of Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Remember, you can always find us on Facebook. Look up WLRN Sundial. Our Twitter handle is at WLRN Sundial. We got a busy show today. Before we get anything going, though, I want to turn over to WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter, Peter Hayden. He was at Port Everglades this morning. The Royal Caribbean cruise liner, the Adventure of the Seas, had arrived with a very special cargo. And I want to turn things over now to Peter Hayden. Peter, unique cargo. This cruise liner brought in folks from the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico, rescuing them from really all the devastation from Hurricane Maria. Tell us a little bit about what you saw this morning. All right, Peter, do we have you there? All right, we thought we had Peter Hayden on the line. We'll see if we can bring him in. We'll get him in a little bit later on. Again, a really fascinating story. Again, the Royal Caribbean cruise liner Adventure of the Seas was at Port Everglades this morning, and it had brought in folks from the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico. Basically, they turned nobody down. They took in anyone who needed to come back to the United States. We had folks who were reuniting with family members. We had folks who were coming here basically looking for refuge, looking for an opportunity to just to find some help, because there isn't a whole lot going on when it comes to getting basic food and supplies and water and medical care. We'll find out more on that story a little bit later on today. We'll have reporting from Peter Hayden, and he'll let us know about what's happening there. But meanwhile, let's turn over to the Keys, because we talked about Hurricane Maria yesterday. Let's talk about the fact that it was just barely a month ago, not even a month ago, that Hurricane Irma barreled through the Keys, barreled through Florida, causing a lot of damage. There's still people trying to get their lives back together, back to some kind of normalcy, especially in parts of the Middle Keys that really took a big hit. I want to bring in a couple of folks joining us now. WLRN's reporter Nancy Klinger. She is in the Key West Bureau, the southernmost bureau in Key West, I should say. Nancy, welcome.
Thanks, Louis. Glad to be here.
Always great to have you. And joining us is also the mayor of Monroe County, George Nugent. And I can't really tell you where he's at because he's always out and about, or at least that's what his folks tell me. Mayor Nugent, where are you today?
Well, right now I came home to grab a sandwich and I'm at my house.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm glad that that you're able to join us today, because we really want to get a picture of what's going on in the recovery. So much has been kind of forgotten in the headlines, of course, because we've been talking so much about Hurricane Maria. But your experience and everything that you've seen so far, how's the recovery going? How are people doing?
Yeah, Richard, it seems that one tragic event after another has taken the Keys out of the spotlight. And that's okay, because, and let me be very clear, our recovery is going on. We're trying to get back to normal. We've opened up for business. We're making marketing and advertising moves to let people know that we were not destroyed, but we were impacted tremendously by this tragic storm. And the recovery, I have to say, Richard, and please don't misinterpret what I'm saying or your listening audience, but we're ahead of where I thought we would be in the recovery process. I can't impress upon people what a terrific job the different agencies, both federal and state and local governments, the counties working with municipalities, where we are today in our recovery. I'm hoping everything being what it is today, that 6 to 9 months now, we'll say we're back 100%, except for some housing issues that we will be dealing with probably for 18 to 24 months.
All right. Mayor, by the way, just a quick correction. You're talking to Lewis. That's okay, though.
No,
that's sorry. All right. You know
okay,
what?
Lewis.
Let me ask you this, Mayor. What is really the biggest need right now? What do people need?
Housing, and we need to get debris hauled out of the Keys and get it out of people's yards and the right-of-ways in front of people's yards. But housing is the most important focus that we're dealing with right now.
And are people working? Is business back up? Is there any back to some sort of normalcy?
I wouldn't say we're Key West is probably ahead of the curve because they got the least impact of this storm. The rest of the Keys are still suffering in this recovery mode, and I would not say that we're back to normal yet. Some businesses have opened, a lot of our restaurants, and of course the hotels for the most part, although they were housing first responders and have been a tremendous help in providing the housing for the first responders, are going to be transitioning at some point in time from having first responders and some of the residents in the short-term housing model that FEMA has produced. We're getting there. We're definitely not back to normal by any stretch.
Though. And as a reminder too, is the fact that again, it's barely a month since this happened, and so the process could take time. Nancy Klingener, as he mentions, the mayor mentioned that the Key West not hit as hard. We've heard reports from you. Things are, got back to normal actually a lot quicker, but. Really, tourism this time of year, especially so important to the area. What do you see? Are people coming back already?
People are coming back. There are some hotels that had 100% occupancy this past weekend. It's kind of amazing. This is our slowest time of year tourism-wise, so you wouldn't want to say it's a good thing it happened now, but it hurts us less now than it probably would any other time of year. But they're already gearing up to make plans for Fantasy Fest, our biggest event of the year here in Key West that happens in late October. And I'm seeing advertisements and press releases for other events coming down the pike. So Key West it's not quite normal. There's giant debris piles everywhere, but it's a lot closer than the rest of the county.
And you're talking about that big festival that's coming up. Just out of curiosity, how are officials preparing for that, and how are they going to treat that, again, considering everything that's happened?
I'm not really sure, to tell you the truth, specifically with Fantasy Fest. And Fantasy Fest was undergoing a management change this year anyway, so it was going to be a little bit different, and it will probably be a little bit different than it would have been. But generally, I think the idea is get all these hotels up and running, get all the businesses up and running. There's a few that suffered damage when a tree fell on them. You know, a restaurant I know, a giant banyan tree basically uprooted their kitchen. So they're going to have a longer process to get back. But I think the idea is to just make as much business open for business as you can, especially by then.
Mayor Nugent, I've been reading about what's going on in the recovery. And as you had mentioned, a lot of folks losing their homes and having to rebuild. And I also read about this interesting dynamic. You have folks who have said, we're going to stay no matter what. I'm going to rebuild and I'm going to stay here. This is home. Don't care about storms coming through. And other folks, of course, now in a situation where rebuilding the cost is going to be a problem and they may have to leave. But what are some of the folks telling you? What do you hear? What are the stories you hear from people?
Lewis, I'm hearing stories on both sides of this issue, as you point out, are for more than one reason are going to leave the Keys. We're definitely temporarily going to lose population, and the reason being the economics of rebuilding. People that were renters have houses have been destroyed, so therefore they have no place to stay. And we're trying to replace these units as soon as possible. We're also trying to get some FEMA trailers in here. We're we're thinking about a host of things to keep our people in good, comfortable housing so we don't lose as many as I'm hearing. I went through Publix just the other day, and the checkout guy told me that he and his mother are leaving. In fact, they were leaving today to North Carolina. And then there were other people telling me similar stories. And then there's the others, the resilient folks that, a couple things. They also have the economic wherewithal to do it, but also the resolve and fortitude to go through this. And I'd have to say I'm one of those people. I'll never leave the Keys. I don't think I could adjust to civilization anymore. And the
Keys, yeah,
home for so many folks. So everyone will have to deal with this, but we will recover.
Real quickly, before I let both of you go, I have here in studio, and the next segment coming up, we're going to be talking with Senator Annette Tadeo of District 40. She's going to be up in the legislature this year, and you know, talking about you know, hurricane recovery and what the Keys need. You have the opportunity to ask her right now. This may not be your district, but then again, we have a lawmaker. And so we've got to press them. What are they going to do for us in our recovery? Mayor, what would you ask of her? What would you ask of lawmakers in Tallahassee this year?
First of all, I'd like to congratulate Annette on her victory. The other thing, she's going to have to hit the ground running, because our whole South Florida delegation needs to be focused on South Florida. To get us up back and running, as I'm sure you know, we are a strong part of the whole state economic engine, and the things that we need to keep our residents here, to lose as little population temporarily as we can, housing is of the utmost importance, and I know that Annette will do everything she can to help the rest of the delegation to answer our call.
Senator Tadeo, it's not your district, but it is a call to lawmakers. Hey, we need help.
Absolutely. And to Mayor Nugent, he knows that I know the Keys quite well, and I look forward to helping them. I know that this is a major issue. It was already a major issue, the housing situation for workers.
Housing costs.
Affordable housing. And we've had for the longest time, for decades now, where the legislature has been raiding the Sadusky Trust. So we actually, I think as a, he's right, as a delegation of South Florida, need to work together in a bipartisan manner to make sure that we don't do that anymore, because the Keys needs it, South Florida needs it, and certainly the Keys needs it urgently, because they're not going to be able, I mean, who's going to do the Publix? Who's going to work at the hotels? I mean, the visitors can come back, but you need the workers.
Nancy Klinger, let's wrap up here. What are some of the things that you hear from folks in Key West or any part of the Keys as to really what they need right now, what they're looking for or hoping for?
Well, the people who are in the tourism industry, the servers and the hotel workers, they want the business. Because if they don't work, they don't get paid. So they want the tourism back. For longer term, it is the housing. I mean, I was at my gym this morning, which is a sign of normality, right? I go to the gym, but one of the trainers there was saying she and her husband were probably going to leave the Keys because they rent here. They have to go to the mainland once a month for a medical issue. And it's just like, this is too much. And this was sort of, you know, the breaking point for them. And they're probably going to go to Central Florida or Georgia.
And this is a story that we will continue with. And we were talking about that before the hurricane. And yes, it is a story that we have to continue to, talking about, because if you lose a lot of people, especially the folks in the service industry, what happens? Nancy Klinger is a reporter in Key West, the southernmost bureau in Key West. We also heard from the mayor of Monroe County, George Nugent. Thank you both so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Louis, thank you for WLRN.
Much appreciated. Well, coming up, we're going to have our conversation with Senator Annette Tadeo about her victory. And, of course, what are her plans when she goes to Tallahassee? She'll be up there in a week. The session starts in January. We've got lots to talk about coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. District 40, Florida Senate District 40 seat in southern Miami-Dade County was expected to go to former State Representative Republican Jose Felix Diaz. But an upset that made headlines around the country, not just the state, Democrat Annette Tadeo was the victor. Republicans will continue to control the state Senate, though, but they now may need some Democratic votes for certain things. We're joined now by, and I need to be corrected on this, I said earlier, Senate-elect. It's Senator Annette Tadeo from District 40. Thanks so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And again, congratulations on the victory. We were talking about the Keys and what they need in recovery. You just got back from Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about that yesterday. How long were you there? Where did you go?
I was only there yesterday to deliver two planefuls of supplies and just went to Ponce, because a lot of people are going where the cameras are in San Juan, and we wanted to go to another area where no one had been and where they really needed a lot of help. So
everything that you're hearing in the news about Puerto Rico, I mean, is it accurate? Is it as bad as we hear?
It's completely accurate, and I will tell you, the mayor of Ponce reiterated exactly the same things we have heard from the other mayors, including the one in San Juan. And I think, I think it's really important for us to understand that it's not just Puerto Rico, it's obviously
the
other
Virgin Islands.
Absolutely.
Yes.
But Puerto Rico, specifically Virgin Islands, these are American citizens that need our help. And in Florida, we need to pay specific attention. You spoke earlier about the cruise ship coming with people. We brought some sick people on the plane back since obviously we didn't have all the supplies that we took. So we had room to bring some people. And it was just really emotional to watch. I went through Andrew. This is how I ended up in South Florida instead of working in media after graduating college. But because we've all lived through these experiences, we know how tough it is without electricity, without water, without, just the hospitals that we took medical supplies. The trees were still in the way, the down wires everywhere. It was really just amazing to watch.
What was, and this is one of the questions we were talking about on the program yesterday, is what can Florida do? A lot of this is going to be on the federal government in the recovery effort, but what more can Florida do? And this goes to what you're going to be talking about in the legislature, really the assistance that the state can give.
Well, we need to prepare, because I think that, there's a lot that we can do along with the federal government, with our armed forces to help and for supplies. And, it takes a little while. Unfortunately, it has taken more than one would like for the federal government help to get there. And I will tell you that the governor of Puerto Rico did find out that we were going to be there. So he came to Ponce for the first time, and we actually met with him. Need to get beyond the partisanship and get to helping people. In Florida, we need to prepare, because there will be a huge influx of
people coming.
We need to prepare our schools for the kids, the growth in kids. And obviously, most of that will be seen in Orlando, but I know that South Florida will see it as well. And we just need, we keep pushing money away from education. And as more kids come, we need to be aware and cognizant, prepare, and not just hope that it doesn't happen, because this happened. It was already happening before a storm. Now with a storm, it's definitely going to happen.
I'm going to get to the election and how you were able to pull off the victory. But I have to ask you about this as well, because it's in the news. Obviously, the story out of Las Vegas. This happened far away, but it again brings up the conversation about guns. Any legislation that comes up in Tallahassee on this issue a lot of times doesn't even get out of committee. What do you envision is going to happen this year?
You're right that it doesn't even get out of committee, and the things, the influence of the NRA and the pro-gun lobby has been unfortunate, I think, even in Florida. So my hope is that, with what we saw in Orlando at Pulse and now this situation, that we start, looking at other ways for us to, in Florida to talk about guns. There, in this last session alone, there were lots of things that, thank goodness, didn't get through. And obviously, now we're going to have a 16th vote that is going to not be with the NRA. There's no question about my position on guns. And, I'm not you know, I want to be clear, Second Amendment is there, but we need to understand the damage. Why would anyone need these kinds of automatic weapons and so many of them? And there's just a lot there that we need to work on.
All right, let's talk about this past election. And again, I said it's your opponent, Republican Jose Felix Diaz, was favored and had the numbers going in. Right after Irma, there was a conversation about postponing this election, and the governor said no. I mean, what was happening at that point? Were you part of that decision? Did you ask for that?
Yes. I mean, we wanted it because, again, I think whether you win or don't win, you should want to have as many people show up and vote as possible. And it was already a special election, so already it was going to be a low turnout
Lower election.
And when you have to worry about ice, electricity, getting, you know, your kids back to school, they weren't in school for a while. I mean, lots of things that were on our minds. Was not. Let me just make sure I go out and vote. So for me, it was important that we have the time for people to get back into the mindset, okay, we got to get out and vote. So as a candidate, it's very difficult. But I think, you know, what we did is we made sure to go out to the community to host barbecues at the parks in the areas that didn't have power and make sure that people were fed, you know, and not campaigning, but just being there, sort of like, you know, once you're elected, kind of things you try to do.
Former Vice President Joe Biden gave you a little bit of aid coming in to help in the campaign. How much did that help?
Well, I think it helped to get out the word that there was still an election going on. And certainly, I think it made a tremendous amount of help. But it also, you know, we knocked on a lot of doors. It was very grassroots. I know people think it was just a hashtag to say people powered campaign. It truly was. This, you know, I got into this race because people in the community in Senate District 40, African-American pastors, leaders asked me to run. That was very unusual and not something that had happened to me before.
So this not to get too wonky on politics, but obviously, you know, this is a seat that Republicans felt very comfortable in. And you know what? Look, with your past, you've been in a number of elections that you didn't win. And so when the Democrats are looking to try to put somebody forward, really, I mean, how much of this was they've got faith in you? And why did you want to run again?
I originally was like, this is the last thing I want to do. But again, it took me back that it was community leaders. The same pastors that actually got together and said, Frank Artiles has to go, were the same people that were calling me. So things like that were unusual and not normal. I think that it's important to listen to the ground, listen to the people who actually live in the district, who lead the community, because they know best who's been there and who knows their community. All different communities are very diverse. I mean, yes, it's majority Hispanic, but also has some very traditional African-American areas that, you know, are very often sort of forgotten once you become a majority Hispanic seat. People don't pay attention to other areas of town, and that's really important.
What are your goals when going up to Tallahassee? And I'm also curious, is like, you know, are there committees you want to be a part of? What are some of the things that you're going to really be pressing for in 2018? The session, by the way, starts in January.
Yes. And a week from today, Tuesday, you know, we'll have a ceremonial swearing in and then committees. And I still don't know which committees I'm on. So it's a little difficult to plan. But I did have a conversation with President Negron, very specifically asking for certain things. One of them that hopefully will happen is transportation. Miami-Dade County doesn't have one senator on the transportation committee, if you can believe that, which, you know, I think was, you know, my argument and my very cordial and wonderful conversation. And he agreed that Miami-Dade County should have a senator sitting on that very important committee, mainly because we are where we are. We are so bogged down with traffic, and this was a major issue in the campaign.
Don't get me started on traffic. But so when it comes to the committees, though, you know, to help us understand, is that how much say do you have in which ones you want to be in or which ones you're picked for?
Well, I certainly made requests. I've also made requests for education. This was another pivotal issue. Obviously, huge difference between my opponent and myself. I think public schools should be fully funded. I think we should actually, and I am going to propose this, and even if it doesn't go anywhere, it's really important that we freeze the taking of funds from public schools and them going to for charter institution, for profit institutions.
You're talking about the controversial HB 7069 yes. turned into law.
Which passed by one vote, by the way, in the Senate. So I would have been that one vote that would have stopped it.
Talking about that real quickly then, what do you feel about all these school districts now looking to take this to court?
I agree completely. And I think it's really sad that we're having to go to the courts to fight for things we care about. We had to do it with solar. We've had to do it with the constitutional ways in which these are drawn, the maps. I mean, everything ends up in court. That's too sad. That's why we need to have more voices at the table.
Senator Annette Tadeo from District 40. You know what? We'll have you back before the session starts. I really appreciate
Absolutely.
Your time today.
Anytime. Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and we're going to hear from WLRN's Peter Hayden again on that story from Port Everglades earlier this morning, right here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial here on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. All right, so we tried this a little earlier. We're going to get it this time. I'm joined by WLRN's Peter Hayden. He covers Palm Beach County for us. And again, this morning, he was at Port Everglades because the Royal Caribbean cruise liner Adventure of the Seas arrived with a very special cargo. Peter, they were bringing in folks from the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico. Tell us a little bit about what you saw.
Well, that's right, Luis. About 4,000 people arrived on that ship this morning. The Royal Caribbean Adventure of the Seas, certainly some adventure that some of the passengers could have done without. It was a really celebratory and an event of great relief for a lot of people and family that have been through a really difficult couple of weeks. The ship came in around 8 a.m. this morning. Around 9, they started letting folks out through the terminal. There was chanting. There was reggaeton music playing, flags waving for Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. And people really, really excited to reunite with their family.
Now, my understanding is that they didn't turn anybody away. Anybody who needed to make this trip, they were going to take them.
That's what the president of Royal Caribbean told us, that anyone who came to the stop in St. Thomas or St. Croix or Puerto Rico, if they could accommodate them on the ship, they were let on. And so they brought people. They brought a lot of elderly people off the island. They brought some people with medical issues, but just a lot of other people, Louis, that, there were two other kinds of people, islanders who were evacuating, and tourists who have now been stranded in the Caribbean for, going on 10 days. And those tourists, Louis, were from all over, not just from South Florida. I talked to one woman from Guyana, and she had taken a vacation to St. Thomas. There she rode out two hurricanes and spent the following 10 days without power or running water, and then got on this what was called a mercy ship to cruise to here in South Florida, where she will get on a plane and fly back to Guyana on the north coast of South America there.
All right, so we have all these folks coming again from the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico, meeting up, some of them meeting up with family and friends here on the mainland. Some of the folks are meeting up with family. Others, they don't have family they're coming to. They're just looking for relief. Where are they going?
They are being shuttled to the Broward County Convention Center, where the United Way has arranged for transportation and for services, all manner of services, representatives from nonprofits and NGOs and FEMA, there at the Broward Convention Center, helping these folks sort themselves out as they arrive here in South Florida. They've got accommodations for them. They will not be staying at the Convention Center. This is not a shelter kind of situation, but they will come. They have hotel vouchers and other arrangements and provisions, medical supplies, etc., that those people need. And you're absolutely right, Louis. There are many people who came on that ship who are not from South Florida and who don't have family here. They're just fleeing the devastation of the island.
Let's finish up on this. Does Royal Caribbean plan on going back and picking up more passengers like this, or have you heard of any other cruise lines that are going to be doing this?
Well, I'll tell you what. Right now, Royal Caribbean is loading the Adventure of the Americas of the Seas, that ship. They're going to load it with all manner of provisions, water, food, medical supplies, generators, batteries, things that are desperately needed. They're going to take it back to Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, and they're going to continue in some relief capacity for the next few days, and then they will be starting their usual tour operation, again, their cruise line, because they say one of the things that will be very important in the recovery when the islands are ready to accept tourists is for the economy to start coming back to life. People, you know, they need people to come and spend money.
But are they saying that they're actually, they think they'll be open for business for tourists anytime soon?
Well, I should say, Louis, Royal Caribbean said that this ship will go back, and I believe within 7 days it will be again in service as a cruise ship. However, there are a lot of islands in the Caribbean that are called on by this cruise ship that were not, devastated by the hurricane.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
Yeah. So there is a lot of the Caribbean that was unaffected by the hurricane,
right.
But obviously some of the islands were badly damaged.
Peter Hayden is a reporter in Palm Beach County. Thank you so much, Peter. Appreciate it.
You got it. I'm proud to be here. Thanks, Louis.
All right. And again, just reporting, he was at Port Everglades this morning where the Royal Caribbean cruise liner Adventure of the Seas arrived. With hundreds, I believe he said thousands of folks from Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands, folks they just picked up to bring them here to help them reunite with families or to find relief. This is a story we'll have more reporting on later this afternoon. We change things up now, and I wanted to introduce you to someone you probably have read plenty of times here in South Florida from the Miami Herald, Jim Morin. He started his career as an artist watching Saturday morning cartoons, drawing the characters as they bounced around on the screens. He won the 2017 Pulitzer Prize for editorial cartooning. That, by the way, was his second, technically his third. Morin is semi-retired. He lives in Maine, and we spoke to him from Portsmouth, New Hampshire at New Hampshire Public Radio recently. He's drawn 9 different presidents in his career, and I started by asking him to help us understand how he worked on the current president, Donald Trump.
I've never tried to put it into words, to be perfectly honest with you. When you're drawing these guys, it's obvious you have a feeling toward them, and you sort of adjust their anatomy to give you a pictorial representation of your feeling. And with him, I'm just as outraged as many others are. So I just draw him to reflect that.
Caricature can sometimes be seen as an over-exaggeration of physical traits, but that's not how you approach caricature,
no.
though.
For no.
you, it's no. more personality, persona, something else.
Yes, and your attitude toward that person as well. And with presidents, for George W. Bush, which is a pretty good example, my caricatures start off really bad because it's almost a literal representation of what he looks like. And then they start to form over a period of time. And with Donald Trump, I think that period, I'm still discovering Donald Trump, my physical, my drawing of him. But it sometimes can take a couple of years before you really, really nail it. And then that is the caricature that you end up using. It comes from what they do, from how you feel about them, from the sound of their voice, from their attitude. It comes from a lot of different places. And the reason why the caricatures start out not quite hitting the mark is because we don't know them. And it's the more you know the president, the better the caricature becomes.
Jim, do you get a lot of hate mail or hate response from readers?
I got a lot of hate mail when I first started because I was new. But I don't really get a lot of it now. And I think that might have something to do with the internet. I do get some. But it's not boatloads. So, you know, that's kind of interesting. I really don't know why. I think it's either they've grown used to me, or they realize that I'm not going to change, so they just ignore me. which is fine. But I don't get a whole lot of negative mail. When I do get it, it's from outside the state. It's from papers that take my work via the syndicate.
You've had a long career, and I'm wondering, are there any issues, national or local, where you've said to yourself, I can't believe I have to figure out a way to satirize this yet again?
Yeah, you know, gun control comes to mind. I've been drawing about that for 40 years or more, and every time something happens, you just... You're faced with the task of drawing something different than you've done before, and also trying to stay away from the cliches that have been created over the years from other cartoonists, and that is always a difficult one. And cartoons, any tragedy for me is extremely difficult to draw about.
Can you give me an example of some of those cliches?
Well, the cliche as far as tragic things are concerned, like 9/11. How many times have you seen the Statue of Liberty with a tear coming out of her eye? I mean, it's almost laughable. That is so clichéic. And it is the kind of cartoon that I immediately just say, okay, that goes in the wastebasket right now. I just won't do it. But a number of cartoonists would do it, and they did. And it's one of those cliches that is just it's almost funny. It's kind of lazy to go with a cartoon like that. And every time something happens, it is. A hurricane, leveling Puerto Rico. I don't know how I deal with that. I don't know if, political cartoons are really good at doing it. Sometimes they can be, but those things are very, very hard, graphically hard for me to deal with.
You know, we talk about this long career that you've had and how much the world has changed. And obviously, in today's world, so much is digital. Everything we hear, we talk about digital age and newsrooms, whether it's newspapers or radio stations. You know, there are people focused just on digital stuff. And, yeah. I wonder how you feel more about the competition today in the digital age, when you can have someone just throw out a clever tweet or a GIF and they can reach millions of people and, back in the day, it was, you had to draw the cartoon out and you had to send it out, and yeah. It was a process.
I was thinking about that on the way in because, and a good example of that is the Chris Christie on the beach. There are so many, really hilarious takes on that where they would take Chris Christie sitting in his chair, isolate that, and put it in different circumstances, in other words, different situations. And, GIFs is another one. It's difficult. It's to some extent, it's a competition. And it's amazing out there, especially with Twitter, which I'm heavily involved with. I really like Twitter. It's useful for me. But it's amazing how much humor there is out there. I mean, really quality. These people are, in a way, they're cartoonists. I mean, and the ideas that they can come up with occasionally are just wonderful. So it keeps us on our toes in a way because it's just another form of competition, and we have to stay with it.
You've won the Pulitzer twice, and I wanted to know, help us understand, really, what does it mean as a journalist to win one of these? What does that represent?
It represents a pat on the back and a nice day where they honor you, and the next day you go right back to work. and you don't think about it.
But you get to say you're a Pulitzer Prize winner from that point on, right?
It's wonderful. It's very nice. But it doesn't mean anything as far as the work is concerned. It's the same challenge for me every single morning when I get up, and I took it very seriously. You know, I didn't sit down thinking, boy, I'm a big shot. I won a Pulitzer Prize. I just, you know, went about my daily routine.
I don't know if this is like asking a father, which kid do you love most? But is one of the two Pulitzers, did you care more about it than the other?
Yes. This one, the one that I won this year, was really special. And the reason it was special is because it was 21 years after I won the last one. And my feeling about this is that when I go in to my studio, I just try to do the best thing best cartoon I can draw. And when I'm finished with that drawing, I see the mistakes. I see things I wish I'd done differently. And that's for every single cartoon. And I'm always trying to make it better somehow. And even after that first Pulitzer, I mean, the day after, how do I make it better? And also, I love looking at art, not just cartoons, but art. And I will fall in love with somebody, and I'll see how do they do what they do. And I'll try to incorporate that, not by copying them, but I'll try to incorporate that into my cartooning, the way I draw the cartoon, and see what happens. And so I've always wanted my work to grow. And I thought that the Pulitzer this year was totally unexpected. But that's why I think I enjoyed it so much. It was kind of a way of saying, you know, that's the way to do this job. That's the way, you know, you did well. And it also was at the end of my career. So it really was a special, special Pulitzer, this one.
You're listening to a conversation that we had with Pulitzer Prize-winning political cartoonist, the Miami Herald's Jim Morin. We'll continue this conversation on Sundial right after this. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. We recently spoke with Jim Morin, longtime political cartoonist for the Miami Herald. He joined us from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. We continue that conversation. You've been drawing cartoons since you were a kid.
Yeah.
Were you one of those kids who grew up watching Saturday morning cartoons? You're watching cartoons all the time?
Oh, yeah.
What cartoons were you watching?
The classic stuff. Warner Brothers cartoons, Bugs Bunny, Roadrunner. I always loved Robert Clampett, who used to work for Warner Brothers, and then he broke away and created Beanie and Cecil. That was a wonderful cartoon. Rocky and Bullwinkle is funny even now when you see them. They're wonderful. The great scripts, the writing in it is extraordinarily good. And I like all the Hanna-Barbera stuff. So I used to watch all that stuff, and I started drawing them. And that's actually how I got started into cartooning. I started copying those things, and then I started creating my own characters.
And did you know at that point, at a very early age, well, this is what I want to do for a living, or is it just something you enjoy doing?
No, it's something I enjoy doing. I was too young to consider, you know, doing it for a living. I didn't think in it. I just enjoyed doing it. Politics came into it later. I come from a political family. My mom and dad are conservative Republicans, as are my brothers, and I'm the lone liberal, and always asking them questions.
What do they feel about your work?
Oh, they disagree with it, but my parents were both very proud.
Is there ever a time when they've seen something you've drawn and really had a problem with it?
I'll tell you a story. My father was a lawyer in a very, very well-known Washington, D.C. law firm, Dickstein, Shapiro, and Morin, it was called. And I drew a cartoon about John Tower. John Tower was a senator who was being who had been nominated to be defense secretary. And I drew there was a big controversy about his, you know, something about defense contractors and the, you know, giving him money. And I forget what the particulars were. But it was a controversy. It was, you know, that I couldn't ignore. And I drew John Tower in bed with a defense contractor prostitute. And I forget what the caption was, but the drawing was controversial enough. And my father called up and started screaming at me on the phone. And he's using choice language that he had never used with me ever before. So he was mad. And what I didn't know when I drew the cartoon was that John Tower had just joined his law firm and occupied the office that was right next to my father. And these cartoons were syndicated. And I can't remember whether that made the Washington Post. It may have, but there was always the possibility that it would, and that Senator Tower would see it, and he was quite upset. So occasionally, I do rub them the wrong way.
Probably a sign of success, though, if you know that you can.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's actually as an education to in how to deal with criticism I listen to people who disagree with me. I don't just cast them off and say, I don't want to hear you. I enjoy debate.
A lot of people obviously know you for being a political cartoonist, but you're a painter as well. Do you get to do more of it now? Are you doing more
of
it now?
Yes. Well, I'm going to. Yes, definitely. And it's, you know, there are people that do bring politics and things into their paintings. I'm not going to do that. Someone told me recently, and it made me feel really good, that they'd known some of the work that I did. And it was exhibited in Miami about a dozen times in various galleries. And the museum in Coral Springs hung some, too. But there's something in the background of those paintings that bring about, you know, the level of dread. Is, I guess that's the best word I can think of right now, that dread that goes through my cartoons. And I love drawing landscapes, and I love drawing or painting people, landscapes especially.
So you're not really retired. You're still just working. But I'm curious as to how retirement is treating you. How's life treating you now?
Oh, it's great. It's great. I'm going to continue on throughout the Trump administration. It's a historical time, and it's an interesting, fascinating time. And I really, you know, I don't know of anybody who's stopping this, even if they're going into retirement. I really want to see this administration through, and then after it, concentrate fully on painting.
And that was Jim Morin. He has won the Pulitzer Prize more than once for his editorial cartoons for the Miami Herald. He joined us from a studio at New Hampshire Public Radio in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Well, one correction I had to make from yesterday said we were going to talk about public beehives today, but we're going to have to push that off for another day. We're going to talk to Danielle Bender about her idea to bring beehives to public spaces. I promise that conversation's coming soon. But tomorrow on Sundial, we're going to hear from Republican Congressman Carlos Garbello. We'll talk about Puerto Rico, DACA, and taxes, and more. Plus, did you know the Marlins have new owners? I think we have to talk. And that's Sundial for Tuesday, October 3rd. Sundial is produced by Maeve McGorn and Polly Landis. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Peter Mertz. our technical supervisor, the man pushing all the buttons for me, Jason Zapka. By the way, our theme music is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Balo. Go to balo.com. And I also do have to mention the fact that we're not on iTunes yet, but we will be, I promise. You can go to WLRN.org later today to download the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for tuning in to Sundial. We'll talk tomorrow.